Yeah, thanks for introducing me. It's quite an honor to be introduced here. Yeah, so thanks also for letting me speak about this work in progress with Stefan Stolz. Can you read this? It's kind of dark. Can you read that? Okay. So I changed the title because last week you all became experts in elliptic cohomology theories, and you understand that the topological modular form spectrum is the right thing to study. So that's actually what we set out to do. We wanted to explain the Hopkins-Miller spectrum in terms of conformal field theories. And the question mark back there says we're not quite there, but I wanted to report on what we know. And there's a paper on my homepage about this, and these slides will be online, so you can relax. You don't have to take notes. So the first thing I wanted to do, I wanted to recall the fourth lecture of last week, because you might not remember everything about topological modular forms. So let me just go through the motivation, I guess, again. So we start out with the Witten genus. So Witten had a Dirac operator on the loop space, on the free loop space on the manifold, S1 equivariant by rotating the loops. And he calculated the index by an S1 equivariant by the Lefschetz fixed point theorem. And he got out a characteristic series. And in the Herzebruch formalism, this gives a genus, which is this ring homomorphism from oriented boredism to a certain ring, which is rational power series with rational coefficients in the variable Q. Q is the parameter that the powers correspond to the representations of S1. So mathematically, we don't understand this Dirac operator, but this Hitzebuch genus makes perfectly sense. So this is a perfectly fine mathematical object, and it has beautiful properties. So it's a power series in Q, but the coefficients are actually, at least on a spin manifold, they're indices of twisted Dirac operators. So you can write down exactly what those coefficients are, and there's a whole sequence of representations, and they're indices. So in fact, on spin manifolds, by the index theorem, this is a power series with Z coefficients. And then the next surprise, at least, well, maybe not from Witten's point of view, but if you take string manifolds, so spin manifolds are those with second Stiefel-Whitney class zero. String manifolds, and I'll try to explain why this is now called string manifolds, are those with P1 over 2 equals to 0. So maybe from Witten's point of view, this is the condition so that the loop space is a spin manifold. So we have at least the spinner bundle, which I'll get back to. So you need some topological condition to have the loop space be a spin manifold, just like the loop space is oriented if the manifold is a spin manifold. So anyway, so on these string manifolds, it turns out that the Witten genus is the Q expansion of a modular form, and in fact an integral modular form, which by which I just mean that the Q expansion has integral coefficients for now. Okay, so that's the story. And yeah, it's a little confusing when I talk to Greg about this. This is an arbitrary manifold with an arbitrary metric on it, no Ricci flat or anything like that. So it's not so clear whether the underlying nonlinear sigma model actually does give a CFT. So it's not totally clear from the physics standpoint why this is a modular form. However, there's a mathematical proof by Don Zagier, who just stared at the formula here. I mean, I didn't write down the formula because it doesn't help you much, but there is a perfectly fine power series in two variables that gives. So, as Mike explained, this ring homomorphism is just a power series in an extra variable with coefficients in this ring. So there's a perfectly fine formula, and Don Zagier just stared at it and showed that it's a modular form if P1 is 0, okay? So we know it's a modular form. And the first thing I wanted to show you before I get to the spectrum is why this Witten gene is interesting to a geometer. So that's my first conjecture. So here's a conjecture that should explain why mathematicians or geometers want to study the Witten genus. Namely, the conjecture is that on a string manifold with positive Ricci curvature, the Witten genus is zero. I should remind you that, say, on a simply connected manifold, we have no obstructions that, or topological obstructions. If the manifold has positive scalar curvature, we have no obstruction for knowing whether it has positive Ricci curvature, even though obviously that's a stronger condition. There's nothing. There are the Gromov estimates on the Betti numbers to give obstructions for positive sectional curvature. There's nothing between scalar and Ricci. So that's why this is a very interesting conjecture for a geometer. And it has been checked. Yeah? Compactness. Oh yeah, these are compact manifolds. Yeah. Oh, and I put up this example of HP2, the quaternion projective plane, which has positive curvature, positive sectional curvature, has non-trivial Witten genus. So this points to the fact that this string condition, you know, this topological condition for the vanishing P1 is absolutely essential in this conjecture. Okay. Now, the conjecture has been checked for all homogeneous spaces. This is a beautiful result of Desai, who actually shows that when you have a string manifold with a non-trivial SU2 symmetry, then the Witten genus vanishes. So in particular, all homogeneous spaces have that. And it also has been checked at the very beginning of this whole story by Landweber and Stong for complete intersections. So we have this big family of manifolds for which we know the conjecture, and we're trying to prove it. It is. Well, HP2 is not string. See, you need a string manifold with an SU2 action, non-trivial, then you know the Witten genus vanishes. So the string condition is essential, and I hope after this talk you'll understand why it is so crucial. Okay, so then I want to remind you of the Hopkins-Miller refinement of the Witten genus. So what they do is they think of string Bordism as the homotopy groups of a spectrum, of the Thom spectrum M string. And again, this should be very clear after the talk, the spectrum. And they realize the Witten genus by a map of spectra to a new spectrum of topological modular forms, in the sense that the topological modular forms allow a map to the usual modular forms, the integral modular forms, so that when you compose the induced map on homotopy groups, you get the Witten genus. Now, I have a little distinction to Mike's talk. I didn't want to put anything up here that's wrong because we're being taped. So this is the, usually I wouldn't pay attention to that. So this is the periodic theory. Mike was talking about the connected theory, and that's why in the integral modular forms, I have to invert the discriminant just to make sure I get a map from the periodic spectrum. But you shouldn't worry about that subtlety. So let me explain this once more. This is an extremely beautiful thing. I should say that, see what I'm saying, or what they're saying, is that this map of ring spectra, infinity ring spectra, is actually unique up to homotopy. Well, at least it's induced map on homotopy groups is unique, just given this commutative diagram. So they start with the Witten genus, which is purely integral information. They construct this unique map, and they get all these beautiful new torsion invariants for manifolds that Mike talked about, the Z2, Z6, Z24 invariants that they talk about. So this is the strength of homotopy theory, that you can, once you have this integral information, you construct something on spectra so that the induced map on homotopy groups gives you all this new torsion information. So that's the punchline in their work. And maybe just as a reminder, this is a purely homotopy theoretic construction where you take the inverse limit over the category of elliptic curves of certain so-called elliptic spectra, and you take the homotopy inverse limit in the category of spectra. So that's their construction. So what we set out to do 3 years ago, we wanted to give a geometric or analytic interpretation of this parametrized Witten genus. I mean, Mike explained why this map from string, the strength spectrum to TMF is a parametrized Witten genus. So we want to explain the topological modular form spectrum and the map from string borders and both things. That's what we're trying to explain geometrically, analytically. And also we want to ask whether there's a physical meaning to the topological modular form spectrum. Okay, so I'm jumping from the answer to the from the question to the answer right away. So I decided to put it up with all the bells and whistles. You might want to skip over some of the bells and whistles, but the conjectural answer is that the minus nth space in this spectrum. So just to remind you, the connected components of the minus nth space, because it's an omega spectrum, that's the same as the connected components of the nth loop space of the zero space. And this is what you usually call the nth homotopy group of the spectrum. So writing down a space whose connected components are these pi n, which carry all the beautiful Z2 information, and they also carry the Witten genus. Okay, so the conjectural answer is that this space is homotopy equivalent to all CFTs of dimension 2D, where this is very important, 0 plus 1 plus 1, I'll explain that. We have one supersymmetry, and the CFT has degree n, meaning there are n fermions. I'll explain that also in detail. So the number of fermions is really the homotopy group here that you're looking at. So that's the conjecture. And I'll try to motivate the conjecture A by explaining the analogous statement for K-theory, which is now a theorem, and B by giving you a map from, well, this is probably clear for physicists that there is a partition function for each of these CFTs, and that's a modular form. So the map to modular forms should be obvious. That's one way, one reason to define this. But then we also, the main point is that we want a map from string bordism into this space. So for every string manifold, we want one of these guys. Okay. And I should say that this definition is inspired by Graham Segal's definition of an elliptic object in a manifold in the 70s. So he... Oh, is it 80s? It's not that old. I'm trying to be safe by putting this S there. So when was this paper on elliptic cohomology that's now being published? When did that come out? The CFT paper. 89. Okay, so I got it wrong. Forgive me. Glad that Graham isn't here. Okay, so he had this definition where he would consider circles in the manifold and associate to those a Hilbert space, and then Riemann surfaces in the manifold and associate to those Hilbert-Schmidt operators. And he tried to make a cohomology theory out of it. At that time, it was called elliptic cohomology. That's why he called it elliptic objects. So he wanted to construct the co-cycles for elliptic cohomology via CFTs in the manifold. And he ran into a problem, namely he didn't get a cohomology theory. He couldn't satisfy the Maivia-Torres axiom. And so one of the points that I'm going to concentrate in this lecture is that that's resolved by saying that we want a 0 plus 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. So I'll try to explain that point roughly now, and then I'll he never tried to prove it because of the following problem. I mean, I think the status is he couldn't prove it. So, you know, maybe... Well, I don't think it is one either, but... So here's the problem. So you should think of the analog is vector bundles. There you associate two points, vector spaces, and maybe if you have a connection, then to each arc you associate a linear map. So that was Graham's idea, just move the dimension one up and associate the circles. Now Hilbert spaces, infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and then to a Riemann surface, an operator, Hilbert-Schmidt operator. Well, here's the very naive reason why this fails to satisfy Maillet-Vittoris. So if you Maillet-Vittoris means that you can reconstruct the co-cycle from knowing its restrictions to an open cover, okay? So in particular, if you have a loop in the manifold that's not contained completely in one of these open sets, you want to reconstruct this Hilbert space from knowing the restriction of this loop to U1 and U2, okay? But the restrictions of this loop to either one is not a loop. So that's why you don't know what the Hilbert space should be. So that already tells you something, that you should be able to cut the loop and then associate something to an interval. And once you did that, you also see that you should associate something to points. And that's the zero-dimensional part of a CFT that I was talking about. So you want to associate something to points in the manifold, something to arc, and then you should be able to reconstruct the Hilbert space for the circle. So we're asking, how can you reconstruct the Hilbert space of a circle from pieces? Okay, and so this is our proposed answer. So Graham was stuck, and I think, yeah, that's he thought he cannot prove it's a cohomology theory because of this problem. But our proposed answer to this is that you should associate to each point a von Neumann algebra, A of X, and to each arc a bimodule, if you wish, over the algebras to the two endpoints, which is the same as defining the algebra of the endpoints as just the tensor product of the two algebras, and then saying you have a module over the algebra corresponding to the boundary of the arc. So this is just the tensor product of the algebras of the two endpoints. And then the Hilbert space is then decomposed, should be decomposed, as the so-called confusion of these two modules. So there's a module here and a module there, and then you take the confusion. The confusion is like a tensor product over an algebra, but the beauty of it is that the result is still a Hilbert space. So if you think about the usual definition of a Hilbert, of a tensor product, well, it's the tensor product over C. You can still put a nice inner product on that, but then you quotient out by some funny relations, and then on that quotient, you don't know how to put a Hilbert space structure. So Alain Kahn resolved this issue in the if you have a von Neumann algebra here. That's why we came up with von Neumann algebras. And the other reason why we came up with this notion is, I'll explain that at the end of my talk, is this map from string Bordism into this theory. It just gives these von Neumann algebras. So to speak, this parametrized Witten genus just spits out this algebra. So we're motivated from the geometric examples, but... Right, so if... Oh, whether the points have an orientation? Yeah. So this would be the opposite, maybe. Put an op here. Yeah, and similarly, these modules, you know, you have to be careful. One should be a left module, the other should be a right module. So probably I should have put op on one of them. Okay, so this is just a naive explanation how to get around the problem. And I should just repeat that what we're doing is Graham suggests that the bundles over loop space should be elliptic objects, so like the spinner bundle over loop space. But we're saying that the spinner bundle over loop space is actually local in the manifold. Okay, so you can figure it out from, you know, chopping up the circle into little pieces, you can figure out the spinner bundle on loop space from this very local information. And I'll explain why that is true. I mean, this is actually true for the spinner bundle on loop space. That's one example of Siegel's elliptic object. We discovered this extra structure in these geometric examples. And then we said, hey, if you have that structure, then you also have Meyerbeer torus. And that's why we came up with this definition of a spectrum. Okay, so what I wanted to do next is I wanted to discuss a warm-up case, which is K-theory. So I wanted to explain in detail, and these things are theorems, not conjectures, how all this works in K-theory, okay? So the analog of the Witten genus is the Aruf genus. And it's very similar setup. You have a rational invariant of oriented manifolds. And on spin manifolds, they happen to be integers. This is like being a modular form inside the power series in Q. That's the analog. And the reason it's an integer is that the Aruf genus is just the index of the Dirac operator on a spin manifold. So this is the analog. So then we're starting with this Z-valued invariant. And we want to get a refinement, just like the Hopkins-Miller refinement of the Witten genus is the Atiyah refinement of the index of Dirac. It's a spectrum map from M-spin to KO, which satisfies the property that the induced map on homotopy, which is then a map from Bordism to K-theory, when you go to the things divisible by 4K, to the dimension divisible by 4K, you get the Aruf genus. So again, this is one of these beauties. If you didn't know, you know, K-theory has these Z2s in dimension 1 and 2 mod 8. If you didn't know these more subtle invariants, which I'll get to, which is the kernel of Dirac mod 2 or something, this is a homotopy theoretic way to derive it. Because again, this map is unique, at least the induced map on homotopy. Actually, here, this map is even unique, just given these integer-valued invariants. Okay, but we also know how to explain the Z2 invariance. So this is how you evaluate Atiyah's map, at least on a spin manifold. You just take the kernel of Dirac. That's, okay, I'm talking about the CN linear Dirac operator. So that's it's not the usual Dirac. It's the one where you take the spinner bundle and you associate the whole Clifford algebra over spin N. Yeah, CN is the Clifford algebra, the real Clifford algebra of Rn. So if you take the spinner bundle, sorry, if you take the spin N principal bundle of the manifold, crossover spin N with this Clifford algebra CN, then CN still acts on the right and commutes with Dirac. So then the kernel is a graded CN module. And the nth K theory can be described, you can think of this as the definition, as graded CN modules, modulo those that extend to CN plus 1 modules. And in that sense, the kernel of Dirac is an element in here. Notice that Dirac depends on a metric. And if you don't divide out by CN plus 1 modules, this wouldn't be well defined. Because when you change the metric, then the kernel jumps. But it only jumps by a CN plus 1 module. So this is a topological invariant. OK, so this is the very analogous story in K-theory that we now want to give an explanation in terms of field theories. But first, I should say the analogous statement for geometry, from geometry, namely that on a spin manifold with positive scalar curvature, this Atiyah invariant vanishes. So this is a result going back to Lichnerowicz. So even is a fairly amazing result if you think about these invariants in dimension 1 and 2 mod 8. There's this 9-dimensional homotopy sphere. So there's a 9-dimensional manifold which is homeomorphic to S9. But its alpha invariant is non-zero, so it can't have a metric with positive scalar curvature. This is a very, very cool result. And actually, it turns out that for simply connected manifolds, it's the only obstruction for having positive scalar curvature. So that's a result of Schön and Yao, independently Gromov, Lawson. These guys prove that having a positive scalar curvature metric in dimensions bigger or equal to 5 is a Bordism invariant. So you can, if two manifolds are spin cobordant, then one admits a positive scalar curvature metric if and only if the other does. And then Stefan Stolz showed that if the alpha invariant is zero, then any manifold is bordant to a bundle over with fiber HP2, and then by shrinking the fibers, you can put a positive scalar curvature metric on it. So this is actually an if and only if for simply connected manifolds. And if it's not simply connected, there is an alpha invariant in the K-theory of the group C star algebra of the fundamental group. And it's a very good invariant, but it seems not to be an if and only if in general. It's an if and only if for many, many groups, but not in general. Okay, so this is the geometric story whose analog we're studying, you know, the analog for Ricci curvature versus Witten genus. We're studying that analog. Okay, so that's one story. But the other part, so this is theorem one in our paper, is that we can explain K-theory and all these maps that I talked about in terms of field theories. So you're supposed to think of this as the analog of my definition in dimension two. So K-theory, at least the minus n space, and again, remember the connected components of this space, that's the nth K-theory. So this is the space of one-dimensional supersymmetric Euclidean field theories of degree n. So Euclidean field theory just means that we have, you know, one-dimensional, we have Riemannian intervals, actually Riemannian superintervals. And to a point, we associate a Hilbert space, and to a Riemannian superinterval, a Hilbert-Schmidt operator. So that's our theorem, that you can think of K-theory, the spectrum, you can think of it as the space of one-dimensional field theories. And in this one-dimensional case, the Maillet-Torres is really clear. You don't have to do anything because you can just keep composing these intervals. You can cut them up into short pieces. Maillet-Torres was only a problem if you started in dimension one, you had a long circle and you couldn't chop it up. Okay. Well, here I have an isomorphism. So the point is, this space is fairly easy because it's really just determined by having one Hilbert space. That's the Hilbert space for a point. And then you have the moduli space of these Euclidean superintervals, and for each of them you get a Hilbert-Schmidt operator. And these fermions in the game, they make this a CN linear Hilbert-Schmidt operator, and then it's self-adjoined by certain symmetries of the interval. I mean, it's a very nice little game. You can read that in our paper. The self-adjointness just comes from certain symmetries of the interval. Yeah. Well, the Maillet-Torres is actually equivalent, if you want, that this is an omega spectrum. So there's a, so this is supposed to be the minus n space in the omega spectrum for K-theory. So that means that the, well, K-O, n is homotopy equivalent to the loop space on K-O n plus 1. And that statement, I'm saying, that's, you should think of that as Maillet-Torres if you think in the language of spectra. I mean, there's a subtlety because you can always turn any sequence of spaces and maps between them, you know, maps from a suspension to an omega spectrum, but I'm not talking about that type of spectra. I'm sticking to Mike's definition of a spectrum. But you're right, I mean, there is a, So that is okay. So if you take this literally, Then KON of a space is just maps from the space X into this guy. Well, that means that for each point in X, you have one of these field theories. But because of this gluing stuff, you can make a more general definition of a K-theory cocycle, where you, so if you just map for each point, you get one of these. That means that you're restricting the intervals to constant maps. But there's a more general notion of a K-theory cocycle where you have, for each point in the space, you have a Hilbert space. And for each arc in the space, which could be non-constant, you have an operator. But what I'm saying is, by the gluing law, up to homotopy, that's the same thing. So you can, you know, make this arc shorter and shorter and shorter. You can reconstruct it from arbitrary small and actually constant path.
So, you apologize the space correctly?
Yeah, this is fairly direct. I mean, once you have this bijection, say, then you topologize this by just using, you know, you fix a point here, and then you do pointwise convergence in these Hilbert-Schmidt operators.
What about the fermions
dimension? So the supersymmetry, that's the second one.
Yeah.
And the fermions, you know, the green K-theory, that's the CN. I'll explain later how this comes in. I didn't want to explain this in the K-theoretic setting.
No, I just worried about your answer to Dan's question. I apologize because I thought
Oh, well, this is a superspace.
Yeah.
Oh, you're worried about point-wise.
Well, I didn't know the answer to Dan's question.
Yeah. Well, so these are, when I write HOM, what I mean by that is when you glue intervals or super intervals, then you want to have composition of operators. Okay? So this is a super semi-group homomorphism. Okay? But now there is a C-star algebra associated to the super semi-group, which is actually very easy. It's just the C-star algebra of functions on the real line, compact support. And it's a graded C-star algebra because of the super stuff. And the grading is just flipping, you know, reflecting the reals and zero. And then this thing is actually bijective to C star algebra homomorphisms from the C star algebra to Hilbert Schmidt. And then you can say pointwise. Then you just fix a function, and then you have a sequence of these C star homomorphisms, and then you say it converges if and only if for each fixed function it converges pointwise. Excuse me? Oh, see, I was hoping I can get away with this in this audience. So it's a 1-1 supermanifold, which has an even one form on it, which is non-vanishing, so that the derivative of that one form is also non-vanishing. So you should think locally, it's like dt plus theta d theta. So it's the super analog of just the Riemannian metric on the interval. Sorry? Oh, just an interval. The body is an interval. And there's a one-dimensional soul. Oh, plus just means, okay, okay. So this is the moduli space. Yeah, I was pointing to the 1-1. So you have the 1-1 super intervals. Those are 1-1 manifolds with this extra structure. And then the moduli space happens to be, again, a 1-1 super manifold. So the plus just means that the body is a positive real number, which is just the length of the interval. Yeah. So it's interval with a metric, but there's also a geometric structure for the odd directions. So you can, for this talk, I mean, you can read all this in the paper, but for this talk, it's actually sufficient to understand this moduli space.
Graviton, 0.1 dimensional, 1 dimensional, and also the super, there's a gravitino. So 0 is the third geometric derivative.
Yo, there is a metric, yeah. I mean, that's the t, that's the length of the interval. So I think for this talk, all you need to know is that the moduli space is this 1-1 supermanifold, and the gluing law of two of these super intervals is given by this formula. Is there a name for this group, by the way, for this super semi group? It's a very anyway, the Lie algebra is the free Lie algebra on one odd generator, which we'll, you know, see from this setting. So what I wanted to do now is to write down Atiyah's map in this language. So given a spin manifold of dimension n, we want to associate a point in this K-theory spectrum, which is one of these one-dimensional Euclidean field theories. So that means we have to have a Hilbert space. That's just the spinner, the sections of the spinner bundle on the manifold. That's the Hilbert space. And for each t and theta, we need to have the Hilbert-Schmidt operator, which commutes with the Clifford action. Well, here it is. It's the heat kernel minus t d squared and then plus theta d. Okay. And you can easily check that with this group law, this becomes a homomorphism, super homomorphism, and that's Atiyah's invariant in this language. So it's Atiyah's invariant is a field theory, but it turns out, so this is what I was saying, a semi-super homomorphism is actually just determined by one odd operator. This is just saying that the Lie algebra of this group is the free Lie algebra and one odd operator. So if you have one odd operator, you can just write down this thing. And maybe the one special thing about manifolds is that it actually is true that this is a Hilbert-Schmidt operator. If you start with any old odd Fredholm operator, this will not be Hilbert-Schmidt. But on a manifold, the spectrum is nice, and then this will be Hilbert-Schmidt. So this is one example of an element in this K-theory group. And the other example I wanted to mention is the Thom class. So this is a very important class in the K-theory. So if you have any n-dimensional spin vector bundle over a space, over a manifold, say, then again you form the spinner bundle. So you take the spin frames of E, crossover spn with the Clifford algebra. That's a bundle where the Clifford algebra acts on the right. And then you can write down this super semigroup of Hilbert-Schmidt operators where you have e to the minus t norm v squared. So I'm in a point, at a point in the fiber, and I can just take this guy, and then I can Clifford multiply. So the Clifford algebra of E multiplies on the spinner bundle. So I can write down this semigroup homomorphism. And it turns out that this is the Thom class of the bundle. So it will represent, in our language, it's a map from the Thom space. In other words, if you go to infinity with V, then these eigenvalues blow up. So then you go to the zero map, which is the base point in the space. So really, this extends to a map of the Thom space into our spectrum. So this is the K-theory Thom class in our language. Curly E. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm jumping a little bit. So Clifford multiplication is a skew adjoint operator. So we want to make it self-adjoint. So we multiply by the grading operation. If we multiply by the grading operation, then the algebra that acts on the right is not Cn, but C minus n, because we have to also multiply each element in the Clifford algebra by the grading operation. Oh, that's the negative definite, or whatever your convention is. We use the positive definite algebra here and the negative there. And that's actually a very important change of sign, because then you get HSC minus n, and that's why this is in KO upper n and not KO upper minus n. And this was caused a lot of confusion to us for a while, but this is the way to fix this up. So it's all... Right, and what I'm, yeah. Okay, so the K-theory class can be, the Thom class can be described, and those are the most important classes. So I want to make a remark here, which was quite enlightening to me. So we have two examples of these, yeah.
In that example, we're supposed to think for each point of M, we have a field theory. What was the Hilbert space?
Oh, what's the Hilbert space? I forgot to say that. So you embed the bundle, the spinner bundle, into the trivial bundle, which is, you know, the original spinner bundle has these varying fibers, but you can embed it into a trivial bundle which has a CN action, and the fiber of that trivial bundle, that's the Hilbert space. So actually, this is a very, I'm glad you asked that. In the second example, it's a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So our field theories, we allow them to be infinite dimensional, finite dimensional, we don't care. So that's one of the nice things about this theory. It contains the infinite dimensional field theories coming from Dirac, say, and the easier finite dimensional theories that you need for the Thom class. But now here's the surprise. These finite dimensional theories, at least topologically, not geometrically, but topologically, are more general, okay? In other words, example two contains example one. So let me explain this quickly, because this is one of the reasons I think we can get around doing a path integral that we can't do later. So this is a very standard thing to do if you want to get the Atiyah class from a Thom class. All you do is you embed the manifold into some large sphere, then you have the normal bundle, and if the manifold is spin, then the normal bundle is spin, and then you can collapse the whole sphere onto the Thom space of the normal bundle. Just collapse everything outside that normal disk bundle to this one base point. Remember, the Thom space is just the total space of the bundle union infinity, union one base point. It's the one-point compactification. So you can collapse everything. This is the Thom collapse map. And then if you have a Thom class for this normal bundle, remember that lives in the K-theory where this index here is just the dimension of the fiber. So in this case, it's the capital N. Then you just pull back via the collapse map to element in the sphere, and then you use the suspension isomorphism to get to KO minus n of the zero sphere, but that's always the same as KO lower n of the sphere, which is pi n of KO. And it turns out that the Thom class maps to the Atiyah class. So topologically, you don't need all this infinite dimensional stuff. All you need is the Thom class. And I've written down the slogan that the Thom class replaces the path integral, because remember the way I've written this Atiyah class is really the Feynman-Katz, I mean, there's a Feynman-Katz formula for the heat kernel that represents this guy. And the Feynman-Katz formula, that's a path integral over all the maps of a circle or a supercircle into the manifold. But topologically, you do need that as long as you have a Thom class. So that's one of the reasons why Thom classes are very important, and for us, they're a way to get around this path integral. Okay, so this was the warm-up case, and all these things are theorems. We have more or less complete arguments, well, less complete arguments in the paper. So from now on, it's mostly speculation, but there's a couple of results here also. So now I want to get from this space of one-dimensional field theories to the space of two-dimensional field theories. And I'm not going to spell out all the structure. I'm just going to spell out the most important data. So remember, this is our proposed spectrum. I'll just call it for this talk. I call it CFT minus N. It's a space of 2D supersymmetric conformal field theories of degree N. And the important thing is that the 2D contains 0, 1, and 2-dimensional information. Okay, so the zero-dimensional information is the von Neumann algebra.
So by default filter, you mean something by Graham's act?
Yes, so I'm spelling it out right now. But this is inspired. Graham had everything starting from the Hilbert space of a circle, and then these vectors or Hilbert-Schmidt operators for surfaces. But we're adding the zero-dimensional information, and we're adding a little bit of fermions into the game just to get the degree right here. Okay, so the zero-dimensional information. So for us, this conformal field theory consists of a von Neumann algebra. That's the thing associated to a point. Then a bimodule. That's the thing associated to an interval. And then the cool thing is, once you have these data, you get a Hilbert space for any closed one manifold just by gluing the one manifold out of intervals. And actually, what we also ask for, as usual, is that the diffeomorphism group acts on these Hilbert spaces. So it's a conformal, in that sense, conformal. I mean, there's no more metric to, as opposed to K-theory, there's no more metric on one manifolds. It's conformal one manifold. That's no information, no geometric information. Okay. So, in other words, we can reconstruct the Hilbert space of the circle from these data. And then, from here on, it's the usual story. So that is, if you have a conformal, and we're doing the spin story, so if you have a conformal spin surface, then you get a vector. And actually, I left out here, it should also be a super conformal spin surface should also give a vector. What we also want is, in order to get a vector, we want to have a fermion on that surface. Okay, so you take the Fock space, of course, constructed out of the harmonic spinners on the conformal surface, take it to the nth power, and pick a fermion in there. Only if you have a fermion, then we want a vector. So this, you know this well from the closed case. So this Fock space, for a closed surface, that's just the Pfaffian line. So you know very well, from the central charge issue, that you don't really have an operator or, a number if you have a closed surface. All you have is an element in the dual of the Pfaffian line or something like that. So this is the anomaly or whatever. But for non-closed surfaces, it turns out the Pfaffian line generalizes to this Fock space. And well, okay. The role is to reconstruct the Hilbert space of a circle from the bimodule. So you can do this confusion over the von Neumann algebra. You have this one bimodule, another bimodule, and you can glue it to a Hilbert space. Yeah. You wouldn't, if B was finite dimensional? Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I think part of this thing is a special case if A is just the complex numbers. That's allowed. The complex numbers is a nice von Neumann algebra. So you can think of that too. See, one of the things is that this is a very flexible notion, just like in K-theory we saw you could have infinite dimensions, finite dimension, supposed to be all in this theory. So you can think of A equals to C, B equals finite dimensional. But in the point why we brought this up is that in the geometric example, as I'll explain in a minute, there are these von Neumann algebras that pop up and they're not finite dimensional.
So B depends on a metric on the interval?
No, it doesn't. So this is a conformal theory. The one and two manifolds are just conformal, which on the one manifold means there's no geometric structure. Yeah?
The point and interval of the surface are supermanifolds or ordinary?
So right now we're thinking that the surfaces are super. I mean, they have to be super surfaces, super manifolds. But as you point out, then the boundary better also be a super one manifold, but we haven't quite understood that point.
The surface is
definitely super. I'm ignoring the super right here. Okay, so then these data satisfy the usual gluing laws that we know from Graham's approach. So I should say that if you just have a a surface with two boundary components, say, then the Hilbert space of the boundary is just the tensor product. The Hilbert tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces associated to the in and out. And then this vector is just the Hilbert-Schmidt operator from in to out. And then part of the gluing law is that when you glue surfaces along circles, then these operators compose. But there's a more subtle gluing law when you glue surfaces along arcs. And I won't spell it out, but when you, I mean, it's spelled out in the paper, but when you sit down, you have these data, you can guess what you do, okay? So that's one of the very important things in our theory is that you can glue along arcs. And that means that the only relevant surface you ever have to consider is a triangle. Because now you can cut up your Riemann surface into triangles and you can glue triangles along edges to get the theory. So there's a very interesting thing for the triangle. And then if you think about it, because the way things are glued, there's actually a moduli space of triangles there. So there's not just one triangle, even though, you know, by uniformization you might think there's only one triangle. But because of the way things are glued, there's actually a whole moduli space. Okay, so that's right. I mean, a very good example is, I mean, I wouldn't call it A. In the von Neumann world, this is called L2 of A. This is the canonical AA bimodule, because you want to have a Hilbert space. See, A is not a Hilbert space, but there's a canonical thing called L2 of A. So A, if A is abelian, this is just the bounded functions on a measure space. And then L2 of A is just the L2 functions on that measure space. So that's a good example. But you're right, there is an identity object here, so to speak. Identity bimodule. Okay, so I'll leave, if you need to see this again in the following, let me know, I'll put it on the side here. So, I wanted to make a remark, which actually we were very proud of, but maybe this is all clear to the physicist, that the degree we're putting in only comes, if you remember, it comes from the number of fermions. Okay, this, you know, the power of the Fock space. So that's a degree which is fairly clear because it corresponds to the central charge. So Graham Siegel already knew that this had to do with the degree in conformal field theory. But we understand that this is precisely analogous to the degree in K-theory, which came from Clifford algebras. So this is what this remark is supposed to tell you, that if you go back to the one-dimensional case, there I also talked about the fermions. If you just talk about the fermions on an interval, it's kind of a boring thing. So you take the Fock space of the harmonic spinners of an interval. Well, that's just the complex numbers. But it turns out it has an algebra structure because you can glue intervals. Okay, and then the algebra structure makes this into C1, which is C. Actually, there's also grading. So this is really, as a graded algebra, you get C1. And that means that the nth power of the Fock space is Cn. Because, you know, we're taking graded tensor product. So that means that if you put in n fermions in this one-dimensional field theory context, that's the same as Cn linearity, which gave you the degree in K-theory. So this is now a precise analogy, that the degree in K-theory comes from fermions, and so does the degree in this new cohomology theory. Okay, so this is just a remark which makes it very natural to have these fermions around. Okay, so there's two theorems which we have, two more theorems which we have in the paper. So one should be, as I said, should be fairly obvious. If you take a CFT in this sense and you evaluate it on the moduli space of tori, you get a modular form. And the index is set up so that you get a modular form of weight n over 2. This is the geometric dimension, but you know, the Fock space for a closed surface like the torus, that's the Pfaffian line. And the Pfaffian line squared is the determinant line. And the usual way to say the weight is in powers of the determinant line, so we get a factor of 2 here, which is also consistent with the Witten genus and with Mike's definition of TFM, TMF. Oh. Well, I'm saying that this MN, those are modular forms of weight N over 2. It's just to make it consistent with the N in the dimension. I mean, this is really the dimension of the manifold that I'm thinking of. Okay, so this theorem I won't discuss further. This should be totally obvious, and it's as obvious as in Mike's case that topological modular forms, the homotopy groups map to modular forms. It's just clear. But the most interesting fact is that we have at least an Euler class for string vector bundles. So the theorem is that if you have an n-dimensional string vector bundle.
So when we calculate this partition function, we're not just calculating the fermions, we're calculating the whole CFT, right?
Yes.
So in other words, we have to understand the whole nonlinear signal model?
Yeah, but remember, this, we're at the point. The target is a point here.
So
that's why.
I see what you're saying. So then I think what you're saying is that the partition function of n free fermions from a torus.
Right.
Well, now I have to ask, what spin structure?
Oh, I see. This is the periodic, the non-bounding, the non-bounding spin. That's why it's SL2Z modular form. Well, this is not, so you're thinking of one particular point in pi 0 of CFT minus n. You're thinking of one example where this would be 0.
Right.
But what I'm saying is there are more examples. And one way to get them is actually using these, at least, you know, on the homotopy groups. I don't really know how to do this geometrically. But on the homotopy groups, we can use this trick that I explained using the Tom class for the normal bundle. We're going to get interesting theories out of vector bundles, string vector bundles. But, you know, I don't know exactly how they translate geometrically on the nose. So this
I
is
think,
a...
I think I don't really understand this math theorem, too.
It's okay.
It's not just taking your n real free fermions and calculating their partition function.
Well, all I'm saying is that the Hilbert space... Right. A point in here is not, the Hilbert space, for example, is not always the Fock space.
Uh-huh.
What I was saying is you have a Hilbert space,
yes.
And the Fock space is kind of like a base point, if you wish. So you have a Hilbert space, which is any old thing, and then you have for each conformal surface, you have an operator, except you don't quite have an operator, but you need a fermion on the surface to get an operator. So this is just resolving the conformal anomaly. So this Fock space, just think in the case of closed surfaces, you're used to the fact that you need something in the Pfaffian line before you get a number. So all we're saying is in our CFTs, before you get an operator from this unknown Hilbert space to itself, you have to specify a fermion or n fermions. N fermions, yeah. And then you get an operator, but I'm not saying what the Hilbert space is, what the operator is, or anything. Okay, so the real theorem is theorem 3. For a string vector bundle, we get an Euler class, so to each point in M, we can associate one of these CFTs. That's the real theorem. And actually, so I wrote this in green because this is what we're working on right now. What we actually want, we want a Tom class. So remember the relation between the Euler class and the Tom class. Once you have the Tom class, that's a map from the Tom space into the spectrum. Then you just restrict it to the zero section, and you get the Euler class. So the Euler class is a direct consequence of the Tom class. So we have to make, what I'm going to explain, we have to make a relative version, so to speak. We have to work in the total space of the bundle rather than on the base. But if you have that Tom class in the theory, then, as I explained, you will get a map from M string to CFT, which is supposed to be the analog of the Hopkins-Miller map from M string to TMF. Okay, so then we really have this map, and that's the map when you compose it with this map that's supposed to give the Witten genus. So this theorem 3 is the essential part, and what I wanted to concentrate on is this thing that you're not used to. You might be used to the fact that if you have a string vector bundle, then you get a spin bundle over loop space. Then you can take the spinner bundle of that, and then you get, so to speak, the 1 plus 1 dimensional part of the CFT. But you might not be used to the fact that for each point of M, there's also an algebra, von Neumann algebra around, and for an arc in M, there is a bimodular around, which cuts up the spinner bundle, makes it local in M. Okay, that's the part you might not be used to, and that's what I want to explain. So again, so I'm just repeating this. In the case that E is the tangent bundle, then our Euler class here is actually the spinner bundle that you're used to, the spinner bundle on loop space, and it has a connection along conformal surfaces. So that's the part that's fairly common. But what's not common is that it's local in M. So what I want to construct I have three more slides. I think I can do it in 10 minutes. I want to construct for you this von Neumann algebra bundle, because that's the thing that's maybe not so common in physics, but I want to repeat that this is essential for our cohomology theory to get the locality in M. Okay, so to explain this, I first give a rough outline how this works, and then I'll give a little more details about the algebras. So there's a canonical, what's called hyperfinite type 3-1 factor. So this is just a von Neumann algebra. So von Neumann algebra is a subalgebra in the bounded operators that's closed under the taking adjoints, and it's closed in the weak operator topology. That's a von Neumann algebra. A factor is just an algebra with center C. Okay, so it's like a simple algebra. Then these types, the beautiful fact about von Neumann algebras is that at least in the hyperfinite case, hyperfinite means that it's a closure of a sequence of increasing finite dimensional algebras. So it's some finiteness condition. And these guys are completely classified. So it's not like C star algebras where we know nothing, because these star algebras are like topological spaces, and there are many, many topological spaces. Abelian C star algebras are topological spaces. Abelian von Neumann algebras are measure spaces, and as you know, most measure spaces are isomorphic. Okay, I mean, like R2 is isomorphic to R1 as a measure space. So there's this beautiful fact that you can give a complete classification of hyperfinite factors. That's due to Alain Kahn mostly, and actually the 3-1 case was done by Hagerup. So a type 1 factor is just bounded operators on the Hilbert space. Type 2 factors come up when you do group von Neumann algebras. They have a trace, a finite trace. And type 3 factors are the most complicated ones. They have no trace. But once you write these words, 3-1 factor hyperfinite, there's a unique one, okay? So there's this one mathematical object which is sitting out there. It's like the bounded operators on the Hilbert space, which would be the unique hyperfinite 1k factor. And we know very well how useful bounded operators on the Hilbert space are, so it shouldn't be a surprise that these 3-1 factors are useful. So I'll explain this construction. It's the algebra of local fermions. I'll explain that in a minute. But the relation to string vector bundles is the following. If I take the automorphism groups, the automorphism group of this factor, and I divide by the inner automorphisms, So the quotient is called the outer automorphisms. Then there's a canonical map from spin n into here. So A is totally canonical, and this map is totally canonical. And then I can just take the pullback. So I define a group string n, which has a canonical or defining representation in the automorphism group of A. And the kernel is, well, the inner automorphisms, that's the unitary group modulo the center. So the center is C, remember, so this is a projective unitary group. So there's this group extension. And so how does that relate to the Pontryagin class? Well, the unitary group of this factor is contractible, just like for the type 1 factor. We know this theorem. For these type 3 factors, the unitary group is also contractible. That's a result of Anthony Wasserman, I should say. But it's not hard because this has the weak topology. It's not as hard as Kuiper's theorem. It's easier because we're using the weak topology. So the projective unitary group is a KZ2, which means this group string n is 3 connected. Remember, spin n is simply connected. Pi 2 is 0, but pi 3 is z. And that z is killed by the extension. So this group string n is simply connected. 3 connected, which means that we can define a string structure on a spin vector bundle by just lifting the structure group from spin n to string n. Okay? And now, string n, we chose, doesn't this go back to Heinz Miller? I think it does. So anyway, the structure group of a bundle lifts a string n, that means that the loop space has a spinner bundle. That's why I guess he suggested the name string n. Okay, and now, as I said, remember the string n has a defining representation in the automorphism group of this algebra, so then you get this algebra bundle over m. So this is the zero-dimensional part of our CFT. Once you lift the structure group of string n, it has this defining representation in the automorphism of an algebra. Well, that means you can associate over string n, you can associate the algebra. So that means over each point on the manifold, you have an algebra. I mean, this A is the associated bundle. You take the string n principal bundle over string n with this algebra A. You know, this string n, I should have written this again. Sometimes repetition is good. This has this canonical map to out A. That's by definition of string n. I mean, this is the way we define string n. Yes. Sorry? There's just one, and I'm going to give you a canonical construction right now. But up to isomorphism, there is just one. Right, right. Yes, exactly. So this is just the outline, what you need. You need this algebra, and you need this map from spin n into the outer automorphism, and then you define string n basically by having this map to all the automorphisms. Okay, so the construction is totally canonical, and it actually works not just for spin n. So this string n, I should say, is the case of spin n at level 1 of a more general construction where you fix a one connected compact Lie group and a level, and there's a totally canonical 3-1 factor associated to these data, which I'm going to explain. And this construction goes back to Anthony Wasserman. He calls this the algebra of local loops. He explained the fusion of positive energy representations in terms of this algebra. And in the case, well, I'll get there. They're all isomorphic. But the representation So remember, there is a representation from the group to the outer automorphism group of A. And you better take the one for the factor for G if you want this canonical map. Okay, and the construction is totally easy. So there's no big secrets except maybe proving that this is a hyperfinite 3-1 factor, which I'm not going to do. But even that is not very hard. So these guys come up totally naturally. All you do is you start with the vacuum representation of the loop group at level L. Then you think of the circle in terms of two intervals. Let's call I the top, and then there's a bottom interval. And then, well, there's a central extension of the loop group, which actually maps to U of H. And that's determined by the level. Well, actually, yeah. Well, the level gives this central extension. And then you take the only those loops which are concentrated on I, that is, they're the identity on the bottom. So you take loops in the group that are the identity down here. Okay, that's a subgroup of the loop group. You take the central extension, restrict the central extension to it, and then that sits in the unitary group of the Hilbert space, and then you just take the double commutant. And that's by von Neumann's double commutant theorem, nothing else than the von Neumann algebra generated by this local loop group. Okay, just take the algebra that's generated by it and close it under in the weak topology. That's it. You take the local loops. And it turns out this is a 3-1 factor. And there's a totally canonical map from the path. So remember, this thing are basically just the loops, the path that are the identity at the endpoints. And here I want to take those that are the identity only on one endpoint, and then I can evaluate the other endpoint in the group. So I get an extension of groups like this. And then I can take these guys that end at one endpoint, extend them arbitrarily to a loop in the bottom, and then they act by conjugation on these local loops, and therefore they act on the factor. So this is a just conjugation action, totally simple. And then by definition, the ones that are actually local loops, if you act by them on conjugation, well, that's inner automorphism. That's also, by definition, this subgroup ends in the inner automorphisms, which means that the quotient maps to the outer. And then you can define a group extension of G by PUA, which is in A, again, just by taking the pullback. Okay, so that's it. And then you might ask, well, how did the level come in? Well, the level is an element in H4 of BG, which is the same as homomorphisms from pi 3 of G to the integers. But the integers I'm thinking of as pi 2 of PUA, and then this map pi 3 of G to pi 2 of PUA, that's just the boundary map in this extension that I haven't written for the general group, but there is an extension. Well, I've written it for spin n. This is extension star. So what I'm saying is, this was spin n at level 1, so that means the boundary map from pi 3 of spin n to pi 2 of PUA, that's an isomorphism. In general, this is just multiplication by the level. Okay, so let me give one more slide, because I mentioned the word. So this is my last slide, I promise. I mentioned the word local fermion, so I wanted to. So you can define string n by just taking the special case of what I just discussed, where G is spin n and L is P1 over 2. But we can do better, and that's very important for the CFTs that we're planning. Namely, we can get a graded algebra by taking the local fermions rather than the local loops. So all you do is you take the Fock space of the circle with the anti-periodic spin structure, say, And then you have the Clifford algebra of this interval acting on that. So a priori, the whole Clifford algebra acts, okay? The Clifford algebra of all of L2 acts. But then you just take the subalgebra that's spanned by those loops that are concentrated on this interval, that are zero on the other side. And then you take the von Neumann algebra closure. And because the Clifford algebra is Z2 graded, this A will be Z2 graded. And the advantage of having a Z2 grading is that we can get the whole Postlikov tower for On out of this one algebra. That's kind of cool. So anyway, I might not have to go through this. So what we used to have is string N maps just to the even automorphisms of the graded algebra. That's like having just the even part of the algebra around. So modulo the unitary, the inner guys here. But then if you divide not just by the conjugations of the even part of the algebra, but you also divide by the conjugation of the odd part, then that still gives a well-defined map from SON, and this is a double cover. And then if you don't just take even automorphisms, but all automorphisms, then you get a map from ON. So what I'm saying is there's this one map from ON to this group, so that this Postlikov tower of On is nothing else but the pullback of this tower for this algebra A. So once you know A, you know everything about the orthogonal group. And again, this is totally canonical, this map. There's no choices. Okay, thanks for listening. You can do this for any vector bundle over M, which has a string structure in the sense that the structure group, a priori, you just have an ON structure group, but if it lifts all the way to string N, then you just go over there and you associate the algebra. So for any, if you start with a vector bundle with a string structure, you get this algebra bundle over M. And I didn't explain how you get the bimodule bundle over the path space. But, you know, you can get it. And the cool thing is that then if you take the two bimodules, if you have a loop and you want to reconstruct the spinners over that loop, well, you have the bimodule here, you have the two algebras here, and you confuse the two bimodules, you get the spinners over that loop. So I have, you know, I skipped that part, but you can do it. Well, I think we have a generalized cohomology theory, which has this map to modular forms. It has a map from string boardism. I mean, there's some details missing, and that's exactly the picture that Mike and Haynes have. They have the theory TMF, which has a map from string boardism and maps into modular forms. So formally, it's exactly the same. That's why we conjectured that these are the same cohomology theories. We have another cohomology theory at this point. The cool thing about Mike's construction is he can calculate everything. You know, he wrote down this beautiful diagram. They know everything about TMF there is to know. We know nothing about our theory, except it's very natural, geometric, it has these maps. So the reason we're trying to connect it is then their work would compute this theory. So their work would tie in to compute the space of CFTs. That's the hope, because we're not, see, their strength is their weakness. The strength is it's purely homotopy theoretic, so it's computable. And the weakness is it's not really related to geometry or analysis. Ours is the opposite. It's related, but we have no idea how to compute it. So that's why we made the conjecture. It's kind of, I don't know, it's more a hope than a conjecture that these are the same theories.
This is a question I probably should have asked like 15 minutes into the talk. You started out with maps into the space X, the generalized cohomology you wanted to discuss.
Yeah.
But then very quickly we're talking about maps of the space X into the spectra.
Right.
So can you explain that transition? I mean, it seems that once you're talking about maps of the space into the spectra, the spectra actually is made up from the totality of conformal field theories. Mm-hmm. Then you have a varying theory
right.
You move around
that's
on
right.
X, whereas to begin with, you were explaining a single theory evaluated on X, explaining maps into X.
No, the maps, okay, so this is the same question that Dan asked, and I admit that this is confusing. So there's actually the map from a space to the space of conformal field theories, that's the easier thing. That just means that for each point in X, you have a conformal field theory. So all you have to do for each point, you have to give a Hilbert space. Well, in our case, you have to give an algebra, bimodule, blah, blah, blah. There's a more complicated story.
Conformal field theory, isn't it sort of eating its own tail? Because doesn't the conformal field theory involve things mapping back into X?
Right. So.
So is there an X and a Y? Is there
a space in the family?
Okay. Right. It's a family.
Oh, I see. So the two X's are completely unrelated. In this family of conformal field theories, we might evaluate any one of them on another space. Y. We shouldn't call that X. Okay.
No.
The map to X is some other kind of field.
Yeah. So originally you wanted to say what is an elliptic object? So there are two ways to describe the cohomology theory. Either you give a spectrum or you just say what is a co-cycle, how do you get it, concretely. And the concrete way is actually the more complicated way. So an elliptic object, let me say it again, in X is for each point you have an algebra. That's like before. But then for each arc in X, you have a bimodule over the two endpoints of the arc. And then for each surface in X, conformal surface, you have one of these vectors. So this is much more general than saying, so to speak, for each point I have an algebra, a bimodule, and vectors. But the reason, at least up to isomorphism, these two are actually the same is exactly this Maillet-Torres principle. If you have like a long arc in X, you want to figure out the bimodule, you can now cut it into very tiny arcs and then take some kind of a limit. So that means the theory is actually determined for this arc by knowing what the constant arcs are. Okay? So this is the Maillet-Torres principle in some sense, that you can, if you have some object in X, you can cut it into very tiny pieces and eventually get to constant maps. And then it just becomes a family of conformal field theories. And there is no Y in the game. So this is a very general fact about cohomology theories. Okay.
So X is not the target space of some nonlinear field. There's a way of making
X is the target space, but we're not going to integrate over these maps of surfaces, for example.
So should I think of X as some moduli space of conformal field theories?
No.
Family of conformal field theories?
But it's more like the loop space. It's more like the loop space in X, or rather this arc space of arcs in X. Blah, blah, blah.
Now the family of Birkenfeld the space, the question is, do you choose to consider it point by point as a conformal field theory, or do you choose to tie them together through paths on X?
Right.
That, but the vertex algebra itself could be, for example, obtained by a nonlinear single model.
Right. But we're not doing that because we don't know how to integrate. So this is an example that we've
postulating an abstract.
Right.
And natural conjectures are somehow single what is called the mapping of the space Y into X. But you take essentially the conformal field theory, they basically the linear signal model associated with Y. Tensor somehow with the I think what you're doing is a free fermion of the tensor space of X. And then you have your particular conformal field theory that you can use. You can kind of map, you can label the conformal field theories by target spaces or signal modes. That would be a natural conjecture. And then if you compute the genes, you would get the genes of these points.
So So let me tell you how I think of this. So let's just take the manifold with its tangent bundle as an example of a string bundle. Then what we define is not the nonlinear, I mean, the nonlinear sigma model, what I'm thinking of is just if you have a map of a circle into it, you get a Hilbert space, a map of a surface, etc. And for each point, you have this algebra bundle. Algebra. Now you, as a physicist, you could just integrate over all these maps, and you get one, well, maybe it's not a CFT, a QFT, right? This is the discussion that maybe it's a CFT, maybe it's a QFT. As a mathematician, we don't do that, because we don't know how to. Then what we do is, rather than doing that, we say, oh, this theory, because of all the gluing laws, is actually determined by evaluating these things only on the constant path, the constant loops, the constant maps. And you just calculate, and for each constant, we know we have this theory by definition. We have the free fermions. So then we get a family, one parameter family of the free fermions, so to speak. Not one parameter family, the n parameter family, if the manifold is n dimensional. And then we're hoping that we can eventually lift that to get to become a Thom class. And then the conjecture is that when you play this game with the Thom class that I showed you, that in a perfect world, this would map to the actual CFT or whatever you get if you actually integrate. See, that's why I said that for me, integration is replaced by having a Thom class, because you get this fundamental class in this theory by this Thom construction once you have a Thom class. So we're hoping to replace this integration that we don't know how to do by this formalism and algebraic topology. But for that we need a Thom class, which we haven't quite constructed. So I hope that still doesn't. Okay. Right. Right. That's right. Yes. That's that I would call a cocycle in X, and that should be an element in our cohomology theory of X. And we're not, you know, then you can somehow get a push forward or something in the theory by integrating over all these extra fields. But we don't know how to do that. That's right.
A map, a space of maps from X into another.
Right. So the homotopy type, you know, the topological information should be captured just by constant maps. And then it's just a family of field theories. And the reason we're hoping that is because exactly of these gluing laws. I mean, in the usual CFT version, you cannot do that because you cannot cut a circle into these little intervals. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly how it's related, but it's similar, I think. We haven't related the two approaches, but you're right, it's a similar approach. Yeah, that would be an example, right? If the target is Ricci flat, and you can actually, yes, X or M. Yeah. Yeah, there are non-obvious conformal field theories. There are sense for a point.
For a point.
Yeah.
So, for instance, you recover genera for all kinds of manifolds from that view.
Elliptic genus, yes. Yes.
So you would pick then, I guess you would pick a conformal field theory based on a second model with some part of Y in order to get the genus of Y.
I mean.
That was your first transparency.
Right.
Discussing Witten's formula.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, that was my explanation, that the path integration is replaced by doing this TOM construction. So a priori. No, if you just start with a point, you get nothing, you know, geometrically. I mean, there are these two things. There's the abstract definition, which for a point has interesting stuff. And then there are examples obtained from manifolds and string vector bundles over manifolds. Those give you examples, but they give you examples even for a point by using, remember the suspension isomorphism? So I should pull out this transparency. So there's this abstract. Here it is. So there's this abstract thing where you start with some interesting manifold and maybe the tangent bundle or some other bundle. And then we construct, hopefully, this TOM class. And here you should replace KON by whatever, CFTN, the new cohomology theory. Well, then you have this map. And now, because it's a cohomology theory, you have a suspension isomorphism. So out of this thing on a manifold and a bundle, you, by algebraic topology, because it's a cohomology theory, you construct something for a point. So this is the theory at a point, but in degree n. And I'm thinking, and in the perfect world, this is the way we construct it. But then if there is a Ricci flat manifold, Ricci flat target, then you can also do the path integral, and you get something in here. And in a perfect world, this would agree, just like it does for the Atiyah class.
So you mean if
M was Ricci flat, and you took the tangent bundle, you did this construction, then our theory would give you an element here. Then you do this algebraic topology, you get an element here. But that element should equal the path integral of, that should be the nonlinear sigma model.
So that's the analog of the T-Singer index theorem.
Yeah, right. Right. But, you know, we don't know this right-hand side, so we're working on the left-hand side.
Other questions?
Confusions.